From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Legendary correspondent for the New York Times, R.W. Johnny Appel, has traveled around the world and across the country, reporting on the biggest stories of four decades, from the Rockefeller campaign and Vietnam War to war in Iraq and Kerry versus Bush. In all those years of top-tier reporting on American power and politics and great personalities, Appel built a second legend, too, as a man who lived well, very well, in every city he touched, who soaked up not just the politics, but the art and architecture, the finest food and the wine with a singular gusto. Now he's sharing those notebooks, visiting, revisiting, and writing about Miami, San Francisco, Honolulu, Milwaukee, Buffalo, and many more, America's great cities. Tonight on Point, Traveling America with the New York Times correspondent and gourmand, R.W. Johnny Appel. You can join the conversation tonight. What's at the top of your great American cities list? What city do you love and why? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is R.W. Johnny Appel, longtime correspondent and now associate editor for the New York Times. He's covered American politics and the world since 1963 for the Times. He was bureau chief for the paper in Saigon, Lagos, Nairobi, London, and Moscow. But tonight, he's all about Chicago, New Orleans, Atlanta, and maybe a touch of Toronto and Montreal. His new book is Appel's America, The Discriminating Traveler's Guide to 40 Great Cities in the United States and Canada. Good evening and welcome, Johnny Appel.
Good evening, Tom. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks so much for being with us. We're looking forward to doing a little audio traveling with you tonight. Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire tonight is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Brother Appel.
How are you, Jack?
Just fine, thanks. Great book. I just am enjoying the heck out of it.
Well, thanks so much. It's been fun. It's been fun accumulating all of this stuff, becoming a legend, if that's what I've become, according to Tom.
Yeah, well, we'll give it to you tonight.
All right, then I'll give it back at the end.
Yeah, give it back. Remind us of your great shifting of gears, how you've shifted from being the guy who was doing the big story on all the big stories to being the guy who's doing the big food and wine story and getting so deep into America's cities on the travel side, just in career terms, in personal terms. How did that happen?
Well, the hated 65 approached, and I could no longer really pretend to be as vigorous as I was, as spry as I was when I was 25. Also, it was time to let some other people in on the act. I didn't want to be a Bigfoot and block people from the top reporting jobs on wars and foreign bureaus and elections. So Joel Ulliveld, who was then the executive editor, said, well, you've always been interested in architecture and music, painting, food, drink, history. I know you write about those things for magazines, and indeed
yeah.
I did.
Yeah.
Why don't you do it for us? And that'll give you another career. And I embraced that with delight.
In retrospect, it's
like I still do a little bit of the old tricks, a few of the old tricks.
Yeah.
I did some coverage of the presidential campaign,
mm-hmm.
as you mentioned a few
mm-hmm.
moments ago.
Mm-hmm. A stroke of genius on Joel Ulliveld's part, it looks like, in retrospect. And oddly enough, he was with us this week. We're bookending this week with Joe on Monday night and you, Johnny Appel, on Friday. It's not as if you had to go out and meet these cities for the first time. These were places that you'd been on campaign trips and political stumping tours and reporting visits for many, many years.
Yes, I had, and I'm a keeper of notebooks and names. I knew where I liked to eat in a lot of the places. I knew which pictures in which museums I enjoyed seeing. But I went back and filled out the picture as best I could. I read a lot of earlier travelers' books. I read Simone de Beauvoir on the American South, John Gunther, one of the great travelers of the 30s and 40s. I read a number of WPA state guides, those were written during the Depression by out-of-work reporters and illustrated by out-of-work photographers, including the famous Walker Evans on some of the southern states. That all of that provided a framework, and then I began doing what we all do when we go out to do reporting. I asked friends and friends of friends to help me. For example, I was not foolish enough to go to Buffalo without picking Tim Russert's brain.
Yeah, I had to laugh. That's quite a list of friends and friends of friends that you're referencing here. This is not packing the family up in the station wagon. I mean, when you're in Atlanta, you're touching base with Jimmy Carter, Kansas City with Calvin Trillin, Las Vegas with Steve Wynn, Minneapolis with Walter Mondale. I mean, this is definitely the Bigfoot's Rolodex at work.
Well, you want to use what you've got, don't you?
Yes, you do. And I have to say, I want to jump into these cities and hear you on a lot of them, but I've got to also just point out for our listeners tonight, this is anything but, I mean, but this kind of Jack Kerouac on the road in the back of a flatbed truck with an old bottle of rye whiskey. This is platinum credit card travel. This is tip-top. This is deluxe. I mean, you're at the Four Seasons. You're at the Ritz. You're at the top of the restaurant food chain in every city.
Well, not
touch.
Entirely.
All right.
In terms of hotels, I certainly am, although I often stay in Marriott Courtyards, but I didn't see much point in putting those in.
We know where they are.
We know where they are and what they are. But you'll find small and inexpensive and characteristic regional restaurants all through the book. Let's say Los Angeles, the place where they invented the French dip sandwich. Washington, Ben's Chili Bowl.
Or in Dallas, a place I know well, Sonny Bryan's, the barbecue.
Indeed, right across the street from the Parkland Hospital where they took President Kennedy when he was shot.
So concrete block shack, as you say, where you slice the atmosphere with a knife and wash it all down with Shiner Bock. But there's a lot of quite fine dining in here. And before we jump in, Jack Bita, I just want to get you in here on Johnny Apples. Take Apples America. Yes, it's got its corners of democratic color, but it's a high living America.
Well, it sure is, and I see that his best place to stay in Los Angeles is the Bel Air Hotel, where my wife and I stayed for one night. And you know, it's one of the few places I've ever been that really, really made me want to be rich. I mean,
it's
I don't
best
think
hotel
of being,
in the country, in my view.
It's just the way people treat you, and as we walked in, there was a portrait of Grace Kelly. and you know, I mean,
no less.
I mean, it was the kind of place Grace would stay if she was still with us in Los Angeles. I mean, it's a fabulous, charming place with swans in the garden, and there are some rattlesnakes up in the hills. But but that is a world class place, isn't it? Huh?
And right in the middle of Apples America, Johnny Apple. We want to dive into some cities, but let us ask you first. The mythology today is America's homogenized. It's all, you know, chains this and franchise that and melded together into one great swirl. Are you still carrying the flag for local, regional distinction in these cities? Is it still out there?
It is. It isn't at the edges of the cities. Every city in America, or almost everyone, is ringed by rather, let us say, aesthetically unappealing mass of fast food joints, car dealerships, usually secondhand, and other such establishments. But when you get into the heart of the city, when you begin looking at it, at its culture, at its history, at its politics, for example, Chicago politics, Boston politics, and Los Angeles politics couldn't be less alike.
Yeah.
The cultural life of X, Y, and Z is different. Of course, the ethnicity, and hence to some degree, the culinary traditions are different. There's still a lot of distinctiveness about American cities. Nobody would get lost in Charleston, South Carolina, and think that he or she was in Detroit.
So sit us down to that distinctiveness, and let's start doing it through food. Sit us down to a Johnny Apple meal that will let us know exactly where we are and nowhere else.
Well, almost any meal that you eat in New Orleans will tell you where you are, because almost any meal you eat in New Orleans will have ingredients that are unique to that city. Gulf shrimp, cooked in shrimp etouffee, a famous Cajun dish, or shrimp remoulade. And it's remoulade as in New Orleans remoulade, which has only the most remote resemblance to French remoulade sauce. In New Orleans, also, you get gumbo, made either with filet or with okra to make it thick. All sorts of things there you don't see elsewhere. If you want me to do a meal for you, you could do that at Commander's Palace, or you could do it at Galatoire's, where a wonderful dish called oysters en brochette, little tiny oysters on a little tiny twig, deep fried. All of these kinds of dishes are very much part of the identity of New Orleans, as are cocktails like Sazeracs made with Pernod and bourbon, and as are at a place like Galatoire's, the waiters, whom the regular customers call Cher, whether they're male or female.
Right, and get intimate in a hurry. Jack Beatty, did it make you want to get back on the road or on the first-class plane?
Yeah, maybe want to get on the credit card. Somebody else's, preferably. Yeah,
well,
and I don't fly first class.
Oh, all right then. But when you get there, boy, it's looking good. We're talking tonight with R.W. Apple, longtime correspondent for The New York Times. His new book is Apple's America, talking about living large in the great cities of America. You can join us tonight. What city do you love? Why? And what do you find when you travel? Are America's great cities holding on to their unique personalities? You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about living large in the great cities of America with R.W. Johnny Apple, fabled correspondent and gourmand for The New York Times. He's talking tonight about cities. This isn't Oxford, Mississippi, no Edge of Wilderness, Fairbanks, no Paducah fried okra, the best I've had, or alligator steaks after an Everglades hunt. This is about America's big cities, great cities. You can join us tonight. What American city gets under your skin? And are you still gung-ho for travel? Do you still lust for New Orleans gumbo, Milwaukee's bratwurst, a Kansas City steak? Or are you happy now with your remote and the travel channel? Where do we find you? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Johnny Apple's new book is Apple's America, the discriminating traveler's guide to 40 great cities in the United States and Canada. Raymond is calling from one of the cities on his list, Milwaukee. Hi, Raymond. You're on the air.
Good evening to you and your guests.
Good
yeah,
evening.
We have the best bratwurst.
Amen.
The city's going down politically. I mean, we just recently had a big settlement of white police officers receiving $2 million for discrimination when just 3 weeks ago white police officers beat a black man senseless. And even when the police came to stop the beating continued. So we might have great bratwurst, but I wouldn't come here to visit. I would go to Austin when I toured with a rock band around this wonderful country of ours. You're right. It's so homogenized. Some of the cities still stick out in my mind after years of touring, and
yeah,
Austin is one of them.
Why Austin, Raymond? What do you love there?
The food, the vibe, the people, the bats, the location, everything about Austin. I did not think I was in Texas when I was in Austin.
Did you say the bats? I've been to Austin, and I miss the bats.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. You have
the flocks at night?
It's mind-bending. You have to go there. It's a certain time of year, only when, I guess spring.
They live under a bridge.
Yes, and it's the largest mass of mammals on Earth congregated in one area.
And they come soaring out at dusk.
That's a city.
Yes. So my hat's off to Austin and everything about it.
Raymond, we got it. Thanks for your call. Johnny Apple, pick them both up. Milwaukee with Raymond's proviso and Austin.
Well, Milwaukee is a fascinating town because of its history. Was settled largely by Germans. As a result of that, it has bratwurst, but a lot more. It has a wonderful museum with a spectacular new bridge leading to it by the great Spanish architect Santiago Calatrava. Mm-hmm. It's the first thing he's done in the United States, and it is as much a symbol of modern Milwaukee as the Opera House in Sydney is of that city in Australia. Many other things in Milwaukee I find appealing. The lake, the fact that it's a great deal like Chicago, but a great deal smaller. Wonderful ethnic restaurants on the south side with Polish and Serbian food.
And what do you love there? What does Johnny Apple eat when he's in Milwaukee?
Well, I think one of the most underrated restaurants, elegant restaurants in the country, is in Milwaukee, and its name will come to me in one moment.
I'm looking
Sanford,
down,
it's called.
Sanford, yeah.
On
North Jackson.
By a guy called Sandy D'Amato. It's mm-hmm. in his father's or grandfather's butcher shop, but you'd never know it. It's been beautifully converted, and he is a man at home in almost any cuisine you can think of. At the other extreme in Milwaukee is a restaurant called the Three Brothers, which is in an old Schlitz tavern on the south side, where they serve burek and other Serbian things. And the proprietor, who's an elderly Serbian gent, goes from table to table in the black beret and talks about the old days.
And you've got him serving succulent roast lamb and suckling pig and chicken paprikash, and right on it goes. What about Raymond's plaint here? And this isn't the only city where you can bring it up. I mean, cities have murder and mayhem, too. How do they
cities
figure?
Cities do have murder and mayhem. I don't think Milwaukee has anything like as serious a problem as Baltimore does. Right at the moment, I think it has the most serious crime problem of any of the cities that I write about. And in the book, I try to balance an appreciation for what's good about the city with open-eyed recognition of what isn't good about it. And it's not only crime that's a problem. It's schools. It's cutbacks in federal funding for urban renewal, many, many, many problems. But this is not a horrible time for American cities. Great things are happening. Wonderful buildings are being put up. This is one of the most fruitful periods in American architectural history right now. Mm. Great architects from all over the world are building buildings. Notably, but not exclusively, museums all over the place, in Texas, in Milwaukee, in new ones in mm-hmm. Washington, in Boston, which you surely know about.
Yes, we do.
Seattle, Kansas City. This is an amazing thing. The museum in America used to be a place for the elite. Now it's a place where school children go in huge numbers and where people gather for Sunday afternoon and Saturday afternoon and on holidays. They have become the cultural magnets of our cities.
Now your approach here in each city is to come in and kind of give it the big correspondence once over first. I mean, by the time we get introduced to the city, we understand sort of the power structure there, the history, the kind of main cultural channels, so that we can sit down and be in the middle of a conversation in that city and know what's going on. Raymond said he loves Austin. Swing us south to Austin and its neighbor.
Well, I think
San
the
Antonio.
Reason Raymond loves Austin is that Austin is a huge music town, not only for rock, which is what he was involved in, but country and western, all sorts of things. They have an enormous annual festival called South by Southwest, and at any given moment, quite apart from the festival, there are dozens upon dozens of live music venues in Austin. Austin's great attractions are music. I think for those who like politics, it's one of the more interesting political towns. It's the state capital, of course.
It's got Tom DeLay's attention at the moment.
Yes, indeed.
In a big way, he's in trouble.
It's surrounded by small towns that have some of America's greatest barbecue. Kreutz's in Lockhart, Texas, is an example.
Get out in that hill country and you're going to enjoy it.
Yeah, and you can go up into the hill country and... Right, if you were there tonight, you would be out. You would be on your way out tomorrow morning and Sunday to look at fields full of wonderful blue flowers, which are in bloom. I was just in not Austin but Houston, and lots of my friends were headed over there.
Blue and beautiful. Joan's calling from Boston. Hi, Joan. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi. What do you love, Joan? Where do you love it?
Oh, San Antonio. You know, this
just down the pike from Austin. What is it, 80, 90 miles?
Yeah. Right,
so the way Texans drive, it's an hour.
But I'll tell you what, there's like four really, I love cities. I love cities all over the world. I love them. But there's four unique cities in the United States.
Let's hear them.
San Francisco, San Antonio, Boston, and New Orleans. They're very, very unique. They each have their character. But I found San Antonio, the history. I mean, I went through the Alamo. I went to the missions.
Sure.
I went around. And I couldn't get over it. It just, the Alamo brought me to tears reading the names on the walls. The missions, I walked in. I thought this was an inactive, like, historical artifact, and opened the door, and there's a whole population of folks going to church. I mean, it's just, San Antonio is awesome. It's just a wonderful city in that era, you know, that 1600s, 1700s, 1800s, that is just, oh, God, it's great. I love
Joan,
it.
Joan, we've got the endorsement, and we've got your foursome. Johnny Apple, take us first to San Antonio. As you say, an hour, Texas style, from Austin, and it's right at the top of Joan's list.
Well, I agree with Joan's list, although I would put Charleston in there, too, as being a unique American city, and possibly Philadelphia. But I agree with her definition, the reasons that she likes these places. San Antonio, for me, is the missions, is the Alamo, but it's also, if there is such a thing, the capital of the Tex-Mex culture in the United States. Wonderful Mexican food. It has, you mentioned Nelson Rockefeller in your intro.
Your first presidential campaign trip to Oregon.
Indeed. And Nelson Rockefeller was a great art collector, among many other things. And his whole folk art collection, which is principally Latin, is now in San Antonio, and a joy to see. Really fabulous. If you want me to go through the others, my gosh.
Not in a minute and a half, but I guess to say, Joan says these are the singular cities, and yet I look down your list and I see a lot of cities with singular character here. I mean, look at Nashville, look at Charleston, as you say, Savannah. I mean, that
Vancouver,
definitely Vancouver. Those mountains by the sea in Asia, sucked right across the big pond there. I hate to give it just to Boston, New Orleans, San Antonio, San Francisco, as wonderful as they are.
I think that all of those that you mentioned have a great deal of character. And my favorite city, I'm a Midwesterner by birth, and I lived there until I was an adolescent. So I like the Midwest, and I think Chicago is the most typical American city. And
typical, but by no means does that mean boring. It's an unbelievable city. I say amen on that corner.
Very, very far from boring. Sometimes when I look at the way it's laid out, with everything turned towards the lake, I think other cities ought to have a fire. So it ought to have a brilliant architect like D.H. Burnham to take advantage of their situation the way Chicago does.
We've got a caller from Chicago right now. Let's grab a caller from Chicago, Johnny Apple. Dave's calling right now from Chicago. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you very much for that very good segue into Chicago.
Johnny Apple's loving your city. What do you think of it?
Well, I grew up there, and I got a chance to partake of I'm going to end it with the barbecue, but I want to start out with, we have some great Mexican restaurants, authentic Mexican restaurants.
Frontera Grill.
Right. Once you go there, you'll never eat at Taco Bell again, that's for sure. you'll throw that stuff out the window. But I wanted to go into, I've been all over the place, and you'll never, ever get a better slab of ribs than from the south side of Chicago. I don't know if you've ever been there, Mr. Apple, but give it a try. Stop on in. You know, we can't be beat. And
I quite agree with you.
Okay, so you know.
And I also, and I love Italian beef sandwiches, and I adore Chicago hot dogs.
Hey, we've got a million and a half. I mean, it seems like there's a hot dog stand on every corner.
So you got a big booster here, Dave. Everybody's in the amen corner here. Johnny Apple, let me ask on the Chicago front. I mean, it's just such a wonderful city, and it's
culturally so rich.
So rich.
I mean, a great opera company, a great orchestra, a wonderful museum, and smaller museums as well.
And I have to say,
when
I get back there from Boston, there's something about in Chicago, despite all the trouble in its history, there's something about the way races interact there, which is much more kind of flowing together than I'm used to in Boston these days, let's say.
I think that's true. Not that there hasn't been a good deal of tension.
A lot.
Not that there haven't been incidents, as they are called, rather euphemistically.
Yeah. Yeah.
But by and large, Chicago's leadership, it's the city in the country, in this country, I think, where business, the arts, politics, and other elements work together. That leadership has encouraged unity. And I think the present Mayor Daley has done an astonishing job of winning the backing of all kinds of people in Chicago. Remember, this is a city which had a black mayor largely because the other mayor, Daley, wasn't very good at getting along with black people.
Yeah.
But the present one has done a very good job. He's accused by the locals of what shall we say, slightly dubious behavior in terms of contracts and such things. But he's been a very good mayor. And the downtown in Chicago, his great goal has been, since he took office, to keep people in downtown Chicago. And downtown Chicago is incredibly vibrant.
It sure is. Amen. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Jack Beatty, you're riding along with us there.
Yeah, do I get the impression accurately, Johnny, that Chicago is one of the rare cities that's held on to its white middle class? I don't mean the upper middle class. I don't mean people that live downtown. I mean people in the neighborhoods.
You mean the upper class, but we don't call the upper class.
That's right. We don't dare use that term. I mean, but that does seem to me to be striking about every time I go there. It does seem to be different from Boston, which is, I think, losing its middle class. People simply can't afford to live there. And then you have pictures of other cities. You've got a picture of the Trinity River going through Dallas, where on one side of the river, median income, $200,000. On the other side of the river, median income, $11,000.
In Chicago, it sounds like losing its middle class. Washington is losing its middle class.
But not Chicago. Am I right about that?
You are quite right. And this has been Richie Daley's goal since he first took office, and I think he's done an astonishingly successful job of it. As I say, there are other criticisms of him, but he has kept the middle class in Chicago, has kept Chicago from being hollowed out, which is such a problem in other cities, Philadelphia, for example, Washington.
Philadelphia, let's turn there for a moment. I have to say, I don't know. That one I go back and forth on. The history's so great, a lot that's wonderful. But, man, the last time I was there, it was kind of surly and half empty too early in the night, and I wasn't having a good time.
I think you're quite right. They're trying. I say in the book that it's a city on second base wondering whether it can ever get home. It is not what it once was in economic terms, when it had big engines like the Pennsylvania Railroad, Curtis Publishing, the Saturday Evening Post, Wanamaker's Department Store, all of those went, and the famous Philadelphia Evening Bulletin went. They've begun to try to see whether they can use cultural and historical tourism as a way to bring downtown back. They've got an enormous new concert hall, a very good one. They've got a plan to bring the Barnes collection, a collection of glorious modern paintings, which is out in Marion in the suburbs and very inaccessible. They're going to try to bring that into town.
Been stuck there by a detailed will, as I recall.
Yeah, a rather demented collector who wasn't sure that anybody was good enough to see his pictures.
They're going to try and bring it down to Philadelphia and get it cranked up there. We've got more cities to look at. Johnny Apple, Jack Beatty, please stand by. We are talking tonight about living large in the great cities of America with R.W. Apple, longtime New York Times correspondent, in his new book, Apple's America, The Discriminating Traveler's Guide to 40 Great Cities in the United States and Canada. You can join the conversation tonight. What American city gets under your skin? And is Johnny Apple's travelogue on your travel wavelength? Can you afford to be a discriminating traveler in these United States? We're 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with R.W. Apple. Johnny Apple, fabled correspondent and gourmand for the New York Times. His new book is Apple's America, Living Large in These United States, in Johnny Apple's book. You can join us tonight. Well, what's the city? What does it for you? What flips your trigger? And what about the other side of American travel? Have you checked out the Bob Evans in Indiana, the Shoney's in Atlanta, the Fridays at O'Hare Airport? It's not all gourmet territory out there. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Tom's calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just thinking about San Francisco, but then the discussion earlier about Chicago reminded me of the old Comiskey Park. I visited there, and they had the best ballpark food that I remember ever having, and I would take trips across the country with a friend of mine, and we'd go to all as many cities as we could, Buffalo and Toledo, as well as Chicago and San Francisco. I was thinking the Stinking Rose, which was out in, I guess, is that Columbus or something? It's near North Beach in San Francisco.
The Stinking Rose. Now why
it's a garlic restaurant.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All garlic all the time.
Yeah, apparently so. I don't know. I went there once and I enjoyed it, but it was like one of those things that you see. I love going to visit San Francisco and seeing, you know, it was like you're intrigued by at least the label on the restaurant. So, I'm going to go have to check that place out. And they did, and it was pretty good. Small but nice, you know.
Right. And then you went, and San Francisco sticks with you even after the garlic fades. Tom, thanks for calling. Johnny Apple, you write about San Francisco in very glowing terms, but in a sense almost that it's too easy. It's shooting fish in a barrel to love San Francisco.
Before we get to that, Tom, if I may.
Yes, please.
One point I want to make. The hotel and restaurant recommendations are a very small part of what I say about each city. They're just at the end.
Indeed.
And you can throw those out if you wish. What I want you to do as a traveler, when you go to a city and you have an extra half day or an extra day, is go and look at some of the things that make it special. And the text of the book tries to point those things up.
Understand it. Know it. And you give us a sense of the bones of that city that you can come in and have a feeling as you walk in the front door.
Right. And you can do that no matter where you stay, and you can do that if your budget means that you have to survive on McDonald's and pizza. It's all there. Much of it is free. The architecture is free. Many of the museums don't charge very much. There's just a great deal to see and hear and understand and soak up for the person who cares to make the effort. And I hope that I will encourage a lot of people who might otherwise sit in hotel rooms or in the bar of the hotel to do that.
Get out and see it and know it. But what about San Francisco? You say no one sings about leaving his heart in Chattanooga. I mean, maybe they do if they're in Nashville. I don't know. But San Francisco's the one.
San Francisco is the one. San Francisco is a glorious city in many ways. My problem with it is that it is quite cut off from much of the rest of the world. People there are very satisfied with their life, as well as they have very good reason to be. But you talk to them about something that's happening in Paris, something that's happening in New York or Boston, and especially something that's happening in Los Angeles, and you can see their eyes glaze over.
The Lotus Eaters don't need it.
Lotus eaters don't need it, exactly.
I love your description of buffalo. You say, like a dowager in decline, buffalo still has good bones to remind people of her more prosperous and glamorous days. I have to admit, I felt ignorant reading it. I didn't know that buffalo came from kind of a twist on the French for beautiful river. That was news to me. Certainly didn't know that Joseph Bonaparte, Napoleon's nephew, took his bride to Niagara Falls in 1803. You got me plugged in there. What about buffalo? It's no longer booming, but you've got a real soft spot for it.
I do. I'm very interested in its economic history. Buffalo was perfectly placed for a relatively brief period of time. It was a boom town. Because things that could come down the Great Lakes on their way to New York and abroad came through Buffalo, because Buffalo was connected to New York first by the Erie Canal and the Hudson River, and then by what used to be called the Water Level Route, the New York Central Railroad. As a result of this, there were grain elevators there. In fact, they were invented there to hold grain shipped from the upper Midwest.
Yeah.
And as a result, the best architects in the first 20 years of the 20th century, the best that America produced, went to Buffalo to work. H.H. Richardson, who was responsible for Trinity Church in Boston, mm-hmm. among many mm-hmm. other great buildings, built the mental hospital in Buffalo. Olmsted, who did Central Park, did the Buffalo Park system. Louis Sullivan, the great precursor of modernism, identified mainly with Chicago, did one of his finest buildings in Buffalo, saved from the wrecker's ball by Daniel Patrick Moynihan, Senator Moynihan, who a man who seemed to do good things wherever he walked. And finally, Frank Lloyd Wright, who has more buildings in Buffalo than anywhere else except Chicago.
You don't get a much better handful of architects.
That's not good enough for you. We're in trouble.
You don't know where to. Nancy's calling from Keyport, New Jersey. Hi, Nancy. You're on the air.
Hi there. I'm calling because I was thinking of two company towns that I really love.
Okay, let's hear it.
One of them is Wilmington, Delaware, which is a DuPont town.
Sure.
I love the Hotel DuPont. I love visiting the DuPont Estates, Longwood Gardens, which, of course, has the beautiful flower gardens, and then a Winterthur, which has a phenomenal collection of antiques.
And your second one, Nancy, your phone line's rough. What other company town do you love?
The other company town is Hershey, Pennsylvania, with the Hotel Hershey, and, of course, it's strictly a chocolate town, but it's a wonderful place.
With chocolate in the air, you can't get away from it. Nancy, thanks very much for your call. Johnny Apple, home of a DuPont, home of Hershey. Don't make your list, but what do you say?
Well, Hershey is a little small for my list. Wilmington was a city that I considered, and I quite agree with the caller's list of three things that are marvelous there. I mean, Longwood Gardens, which is between Wilmington and Philadelphia, I mentioned in the Philadelphia chapter. It's probably the best privately built garden in the United States, at least in extent, with wonderful greenhouses that are abloom all winter and then bed after bed for the blooming season. And Winterthur, one is hard-pressed to think of a better collection of furniture in the United States, maybe the American wing of the Metropolitan Museum, but nothing else that I can think of.
Jack Beattie, I asked a little facetiously earlier about Americans' motivation for travel. I mean, I grew up thinking everybody wanted to go everywhere. I'm not sure that's true anymore with 500 channels and the remote and the travel channel there. I mean, it's still so great to get out and see what's going on, but do you feel the same thirst to see the USA in a Chevrolet or any other way?
Well, I don't. I mean, the idea of driving any place would do for me. But, you know, I remember even just 20 years ago, I did an article about South Boston, which is just right across the harbor from Boston. Yeah. And I talked to people there who said, oh, we never go to town. And I said, what do you mean? It's right there. Right. Oh, we don't go to town. That's not town for us. And I was just amazed that people felt that way. So, yeah, people don't even want to travel when they're there.
Too much
and
trouble.
Yet, yes. And yet people travel constantly.
We do.
Yeah.
They travel for business. They travel to show the kids Washington.
Yep.
I'm fascinated by the latter phenomenon. Most of the news out of Washington is bad most of the time. And, you know, it's about selfish legislators and about crime and about what do I want to say? Inside the Beltway mentality, closed minds and so forth and so on.
And yet,
people bring, you go to Washington right now, come to Washington right now. Streets are full of kids and parents. And, of course, the cherry blossoms are in full bloom, and Washington never looks lovelier. But the reason they come, these families, is not so they can talk about the troubles in Washington, those ways in which we don't live up to our ideals, but talk to their kids and to each other about those ideals and how they came to be.
And how they stand right there in all that architecture writ large. Johnny Apple, you keep our enthusiasm up for the whole project, and we thank you for that. We thank you for the new book, Apple's America, and thank you so much for being with us tonight. Wonderful talking with you.
Enjoyed it greatly. Jack, and have fun up in Hanover.
I will. Thank you, Johnny. Great pork. Wonderful.
Is D'Artagnan still going?
I've missed it. If it is,
we'll find out. R.W. Apple, his new book is Apple's America. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Just click on forums. Jack Beatty, stick with us. This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be rejoined by On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
The Holy Father was a priest to the last, for he offered his life to God, for his flock, and for the entire human family.
The Iraqi Prime Minister and Kurdish leader Jalal Talabani is the country's new interim president. The leadership is reaching out to the nation's long-repressed Kurdish minority and bringing the country closer to its first democratically elected government in 50 years.
The department has no interest in rummaging through the library records or the medical records of Americans. That is not something that we have an interest in.
Does that mean you'd agree to excluding them?
We do have an interest, however, in records that may help us capture terrorists.
Martinez says he called his staff into his office and said, basically, Harkin says, I gave him the memo. Is that possible? And shortly after that, one of his aides resigned. His legal counsel admitted he'd written it and then resigned.
As some of you now know, I have learned in the last couple of days that I have lung cancer. Yes, I was a smoker until about 20 years ago. And I was weak, and I smoked over 9/11. Well, whatever the reason, the news does slow you down a bit.
His Serene Highness Prince Rainier III has ceased to be among us. Death has torn him from his family and his people today, this morning at 6:35.
And there's a week the world says goodbye to Pope John Paul II during a thronged week in Rome and a funeral attended by presidents and kings and seen by millions on television. Kurdish leader Jalal Talabani is elected as Iraq's new president, and Ibrahim al-Jafari, a Shiite, is chosen prime minister. Attorney General Abelter Gonzalez pushes for a nearly full renewal of the Patriot Act before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Florida Senator Mel Martinez acknowledges that one of his aides was the author of a memo earlier denied by the GOP that encouraged Republicans to turn the Terry Schiavo case to treat it as a rich political opportunity. ABC News anchor Peter Jennings announces he has lung cancer, and Prince Rainier of Monaco passes away at age 81. Jack Beatty, it's been the Pope's week, really, from no matter what angle you look at it. Just a gigantic presence and quite amazing outpouring this week.
It really has been. And what I've been struck with, just when I tune into the cable channels, they always find something new to talk about the Pope.
84 years, 27 years as Pope, there's a lot to work with there.
Yes. I mean, you get into the doctrine, you get into the church, and then just his early life, a working man, a poet, an actor, living under the Nazi occupation. And for all that people, more liberal-minded Catholics, have felt uneasy with him in some regards, there's a kind of fullness of affection here that really did in many ways surprise me.
You've been watching Washington as well this week while so many eyes have been on Rome, Jack.
Well, yeah, you know, I think we got a look at the future last week. The Senate voted not to block an amendment that would give China 6 months to revalue its currency. And this is in the wake of a report that in January, Chinese imports went up by nearly 40% here, while our exports fell by 10%, our exports to China. And there's protectionist talk. Duncan Hunter in the House is talking about introducing legislation that would redefine currency manipulation as a form of subsidy and therefore something that would trigger trade barriers.
But how do you do that? I mean, China, the grand bargain seems to be China buys up American debt and we're deep in it. That's our side of the equation.
Exactly. I don't know how they expect to maneuver on this, but I guess when you have figures like that, it gets people's attention. And it is significant that the Senate voted by 67 votes not to shut down this amendment that would, you know, essentially call China on the carpet about its currency.
And still a lot of reverberation from the Schiavo case, and really more than that, maybe it's anticipatory vibrations here about the coming battles over the U.S. judiciary.
My, oh my, we have Tom DeLay, who seems to have put everybody except his Uncle Joe, and I haven't checked recently, perhaps something will come up in that regard, on his payroll, $500,000 to his wife and daughter for the last 4 years. He says they work hard for it, and I'm sure they do. He says the judiciary is running amok and that the judicial independence needs to be crimped. And a chief of staff to Tom Coburn, the Republican senator, says that maybe we need mass impeachment of judges, not on the basis of their peculation crime, but on the basis of their opinions. Something is afoot here among conservatives, this attack on the judiciary. And, you know, it's ironic because the judiciary in the run of history has been the conservative bastion, killing the New Deal, throttling legislation in the 19th century. Now it's a big target.
Mass impeachment. You know what they say, Jack, may you live in interesting times.
Jack,
thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
On Point is produced by Meghna Chakravarti, Julie Jopp, Rachel Dornhelm, Eileen Amata, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman. With help from Tim Skog, Michael Garth, and Angel Cozzelli, our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.